This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're bringing you a conversation with Shihana Alazaz. Alazaz is one of the first women licensed to practice law in Saudi Arabia. She was born in Riyadh, and she is a passionate mentor for other young women across the world who yearn to launch their own professional careers in the face of cultural and social barriers that exist in male-dominated societies. Last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, Shihana Alazaz sat down with Doug Fabrizio, the host of Radio West on NPR member station KUER, to talk about her views of the social changes women are seeing or not seeing in Saudi Arabia. Women in Saudi Arabia are restricted by numerous laws and traditions. Women cannot drive, for example. They need permission from men to work or to travel. But in the last several years, Saudi Arabia's rulers began enacting reforms. Some of these allowed women to vote and participate in municipal elections. Women were allowed to participate in the Olympics. And colleges also began to offer law degrees to women. Women could get law degrees, but they couldn't actually practice law for a while. But in the past few years, this gradually has changed too, and women have slowly been allowed to enter law firms and courtrooms in the Saudi kingdom. Well, from here, I'll let Doug Fabrizio pick up this introduction of Shihana Alazaz. This was recorded on Friday last week.
These days, she is with Vinson and Elkins LLP. It's one of the world's leading law firms dealing with the energy sector. She's also published articles in Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. At first, she was the only female lawyer in her office in Saudi Arabia. So as you can imagine, it probably wasn't easy. But she's a firm believer in getting women engaged and involved in mentoring them and counseling them. She started an internship program at the law firm to recruit female law students. And even now, she goes around to schools and universities in the country, talks to young women about these new possibilities in their life. Please welcome Shihana Alazaz. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and thank you all for taking the time to be with us today. I'm sure there are tons of other things that are more exciting and fun, but I appreciate taking the time. Thank you so much.
I wanted to start talking about home life for you when you were a kid. So I've seen your sister, who's an engineer, by the way. This may tell you something about home life. I guess all the siblings are doing important stuff.
Yeah. We'd like to think.
So what was it like? So your sister's talked about how your home was full of, this is how she put it, a love for learning and a love for knowledge. What was it like?
Sure. Well, let me kind of take you with a bit of imagination to what it's like to be a homegrown Bedouin girl, so to speak, in a country where, as you mentioned, a lot of restrictions apply and certain rules. But I always question whether it's a one-off country that has all these restrictions or rules, or whether we are all guided by certain restrictions and rules and limitations and protocols and etiquettes and whatnot that cause us to conduct ourselves in a certain way. And I often find that we are, at the end of the day, all the same and restricted by those same rules and nuances. We come from a family where my father was a photographer, an author, an intellectual figure in my mind. He was definitely an odd one out of the family, where he was born into a family of farmers in a province that is known for two things. Growing the best dates in the world, and palm trees is what he plays with and climbs and takes refuge at. But also a very conservative place, a place where religious institutions find sort of fertile soil to bring about some religious opinions and grow certain thoughts. So. We do have that background going on. At the same time, my mother comes from the same province, but somewhat of a different background. She comes from a family of merchants. My grandfather is a merchant who traveled the world. At the time, was one of those that traveled to Syria and Iraq quite often. So from an early stage, she got exposed to the world out there. She was lucky to pursue a degree in economics at the University of Kuwait, and then from there, Oregon, and then from there, Oxford. So well-traveled. She met this young, handsome-looking guy who was a dropout. He dropped out of engineering school in his second year, came from a very conservative background, pretty different, and, you know, despite all of these incompatibilities, she fell for him as she married the man she loved. So we were brought into a family that definitely encouraged free thinking, encouraged knowledge and education, but more importantly, I think love, and that was the secret ingredient in all of this. Despite all the differences, whether with the extended family or society or otherwise, we all came together to love each other for our differences, no matter what.
What did your father say to you about the role a woman should or could play in society? Your father first, and then compare that to what mom said.
Sure. I must confess, it's unfortunate that I lost him at the age of 16. I was definitely more fortunate than the younger four of my family, of my siblings, who probably don't remember what is his favorite color or whether he can dance or not and what music he listens to and some of these basic daily preferences. At the age of 14, when he fell ill and we discovered that he had a brain tumor, the dialogue among us changed. And he all of a sudden wanted me to be prepped for life. And so he started talking to me about some of those unfortunate circumstances that we live in. We never got to finish the conversation. I never got to talk to him about what happens if you go away. Who's next in line? Who should I look up to? Who should I trust? But he did leave us a piece of paper, which was his will, written on the bed of death. So death was imminent, and he wrote that will saying, here are three men that I would trust for you to go for advice. And there were three men that were three of his best friends that he thought are really good men to provide advice for. He also looked at my mother's brother, my uncle, to guide us through life. And they were buddies more than anything. They traveled a lot together. They were both photographers, very passionate photographers. So he trusted that man to inherit that relationship between his daughters and himself. And so that piece of paper is still something that I hold very closely, and it's something that I had to fight for in court to make sure that it is officially documented and respected. And that goes into a whole different story.
Well, let's talk about it, because it seems like this is... Were you thinking about the law before you had to fight in court for this document?
Sure. Absolutely not. I grew up wanting to be an engineer or a doctor. I was a very scientific student. I actually hated social sciences until that incident happened. What had happened back then is when he passed away, and as we were all busy in our grief and pain for the loss that has just happened, and we tend to have 3 days of service. Second day of service, my uncle's come up to me and asked me for his death certificate. And as a 16-year-old, I didn't know any better. So I go to our sort of, to my room where I kept all the official documentation, handed over the death certificate, and off they went to court. Little did I know that they were pursuing what is called a guardianship deed over me and my siblings. I didn't, at that point in time, think that it was wise to engage in a discussion with my mom, who has just become a widow and is covered in black and is just grieving. So I thought I'll take care of it myself.
And you're the oldest.
I am. I did a mistake, and for which I felt guilty, for which I had to figure a way out. So there was little choice in what happened next, but as soon as we learned that they have done that through the court system, I took that piece of paper that had my dad's authentic handwriting will and took two of his best friends who knew his handwriting very well, and off we went to court to try and authenticate and officially document his will. It was a struggle between, you know, being a 16-year-old female in a before a bench full of men in a courtroom where I was the only female. And my
what kind of a struggle, though? Like, what did they, did you seem like, what are you doing here?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The very first question, and mind you, I came in very wanting to be very authentic in the sense that and I showed up in my traditional black robe, the abaya, covered head to toe, spoke Arabic, the language they understood, put on the dialect, which is from Qassim, the very sort of conservative place where the judge is from, put on that dialect that he prefers, recited the holy book. So I thought I had the toolkit. I thought, you know, everything that I need is there. And as soon as I tried to argue, I was asked to leave the room because I was a woman. So it was that gender that played a role in that courtroom that day. And unfortunately, the questions that I got asked were illogical because I was asked about, well, what are you doing here? Where is your guardian? Well, if I had one, I wouldn't be here in the first place, right? So unfortunately, that didn't go well. And I remember leaving the courtroom that day thinking to myself, I'm just going to leave. This is not a fight that I want to fight. This is not a debate that I want to get in. It's so irrational. I can't get a grip around it. So you know what? To the hell with all of this. My mom quickly reminded me that, well, false targets are one way of getting things, so why don't we set ourselves a different target? And she was specifically talking about education. I went in as a 16 high school, you know, student, not as a lawyer, obviously. So we set ourselves the next target, which is, well, if you really want to bring about change, you better be part of that system.
Yeah.
That system that you hated so much, that caused so much pain, that was frustrating at times. But you need to come equipped. And don't expect them to create the opportunity for you.
Yeah.
You ought to go and shape up that opportunity for yourself. So off I went to the UK because at that point in time, law faculties did not open their doors for girls. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with the reality, but it is a very highly segregated society where, you know, we have an all-male school, an all-female school. Universities are segregated. Pretty much a lot of things are segregated. You walk into restaurants, there's a single section which typically means a men's only section, and then a family section, excuse me. So it is a very segregated society, and I didn't see, you know, that change in education come about very soon. I mean, I didn't see it within the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, you know, if I can get the education I need abroad, then I should.
And maybe I'll be able to come home and resolve this thing, or what?
There were mixed emotions.
Yeah.
There were moments in time when I thought, I'm just never going to come back. And there were moments in time when I thought, you know, the next thing is to get the family out of there and go somewhere else. But I got asked this question several times. Well, why did you come back? If as you describe it, it's a path full of struggles and frustrations and pain, and the things that are taken for granted elsewhere are everyday questions and issues. Why did you come back? But it's pretty simple. It's that sense of belonging. It's home at the end of the day. And that connection with land and the desert and palm trees and the rest of it is beyond breakable. It's not something that rules, that mankind creates, can stand in the way, for sure.
So, at first you thought about Lot as a way of resolving this issue, resolving this wrong, maybe. At what point did you, because you weren't thinking of Lot before all of that, wanted to do something else. At what point did you think, I really like this now? And when did you start to take to Lot?
Sure. I don't know if I ever liked it.
Is that right?
Frankly speaking. And I think that's something I definitely remind my siblings of the minute they walk home from school or university and start complaining. Well, I'm not sure that anyone have ever just said, oh, I'm so in love with engineering or law or, you know, any of this. It's not to say that I've hated it and yet I continue to do it. Absolutely not. But the road was definitely full of struggles even when I got started in law. The very first assignment I got was a complete failure. Although, you know, I had worked so hard. I've been an A student all my life, and all of a sudden I went into this university with 300 other students. I came from a system where I was taught in Arabic my entire life, so even sciences and social sciences and, you know, math equations and chemistry was all in Arabic, and all of a sudden I had to switch to English, and that was pretty difficult to do. I thought my English was all right until I went to the northeast of England, and I thought, what language do they speak? It was tough, but I think not looking back and not wanting to fail, certainly not my mother, not myself, proving to the wider community that I can be something else other than that black box they've put me in, were definitely things that kept me going.
But go back to the moment when you got the F.
Right.
Like, because you got the first F. It must have been, it shocked you, and I know you thought,
it was a slap in the face.
Yeah, I'm out of here, right?
Yeah, it was a slap in the face, and I immediately was on the phone with my mom saying, I failed, and sorry to let you down, and I'm just going to pack up and leave. This is a waste of money and time. And she just said, just give it a try, you know. You're still at the beginning. Let's see how the year ends up. And, you know, if it doesn't work, that's all good. But let's keep going. There were moments in time where it was torturous. I had to literally have, and I said this before, keep myself awake all night by taking cold showers every 10 minutes to just keep going through these report cases and textbooks that I couldn't get a sense of and plug in all these terminologies into my digital dictionary, and while students are going at, you know, thousands of miles an hour, I still had to catch up. I think one thing that definitely helped is my advisor, I who was at that point in time a gay professor teaching criminal law at university, at Durham University, and I couldn't really connect to. I mean, it was just, again, coming from the conservative background I'm in, I'm like, really, do I go and talk to this guy? Yeah. And he was brilliant. I mean, he just, you know, he told me what went wrong and where all the wasted effort was going and how I get back on track. And from there on, it was just keep at it. And luckily enough, you know, I was able to get it done.
That's Shihana Al-Azaz, one of the first women lawyers in Saudi Arabia, speaking with Doug Fabrizio last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a conversation recorded last week between Doug Fabrizio, the host of the show Radio West on KUER, and Shihana Alazaz. Alazaz is an advocate for women globally who are facing significant barriers in their professional fields. Alazaz herself was among the first women in Saudi Arabia to become a lawyer. She spoke about how her journey relates to the gradual legal and social reforms that Saudi Arabia has been experiencing over the past several years.
So in 2013, I think it was, or maybe 12, when King Abdullah finally says women can practice, did you immediately think you're headed back?
So just to clarify, at that point in time, I was in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And it was part of this attempt to push boundaries and bring about change.
You were one of those who were petitioning for this.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So we were all very gently and elegantly and without anger or violence trying to bring about change. Again, to give you a sense of how change comes about often in our country, it's not through, you know, demonstrations on the streets. It's not through social movements that oftentimes involve violence. It's through petitioning, so a letter that is submitted to the king. Social media created a whole different wave of, you know, conversations and transparency and brought about change for sure. But it's also by a strike of a pen, oftentimes. And I refer to a royal decree that was issued by the king at that time. And that's the beauty sometimes of the system. You know, it doesn't go through a very long and prolonged and bureaucratic legislation process. It's often through a strike of a pen. And in that incident, it did come about overnight through a strike of a pen.
It has so King Abdullah has died, and King Salman now. Do you think he will continue that same kind of sensibility? Are you hopeful about that?
Sure. So there is definitely a continuous effort to bring in women to the workforce, to enable women through education, through social development. You mentioned a few things that happened during King Abdullah's time, but during King Salman's time as well, a few steps forward happened. One of which is physical education for girls. For the longest time, physical education was actually not taught to girls in Saudi Arabia. It was just prohibited, so schools did not provide for PE in schools. Sports were never allowed or promoted. I played soccer in university, but you know, I was a lousy player. I never got, you know, the training I need. The participants in the Olympics, it was a second time around during King Salman's time, was another push towards women participating in various fields of life. So there is definitely continuous push. But more importantly, I think there have been significant roles that were given to women in government in the recent history of Saudi Arabia during King Salman's time. So the chairman of our stock exchange is a woman who's a homegrown Saudi lady, educated in schools and universities of Saudi, brilliant, brilliant lady who's chairing our stock exchange now. Two of our major banks have been now led by women CEOs. A woman who has just been appointed in a very unique role comes from Microsoft. Again, a homegrown Saudi lady comes from Microsoft by training, has been appointed to digitize the nation, and she reports directly to the deputy, to the Crown Prince. So there have been significant moves to empower women and to put them in leading roles and give them an opportunity to shine and bring about change, for sure.
You said something earlier I wanted to ask you about. It was, so there are restrictions for women in Saudi Arabia, but what do you think about America's opportunity for women? It's different in important ways, of course, but I wonder if you have a similar kind of counsel for women here as you, because I think the point you made was, don't get so high and mighty, you guys, about how the restrictions you have. We all have restrictions. So would you talk about how you talk to American women?
Sure. I think when we do come to talk to each other, we often find that we do share the same restrictions and the same struggles, maybe in a different way, in a different setting, in a different context, but certainly the same struggles are there. I think one different example that I draw often was the equal pay issue that exists in the United States and pretty much doesn't exist in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
Which I found interesting, but the equal opportunity issue definitely exists in our country. But I would say a few things. One, make sure that your work is visible. Make sure that whatever effort you put out there is definitely something that people can see and touch upon. So visibility is important. I think another thing that I often see and compare myself to my male colleagues is we sell ourselves short. Naturally, we definitely sell ourselves short. The minute we project confidence, we're seen as aggressive, right? That doesn't come from a man, right? Even if they are less able or capable or skilled, you don't find that similar sort of feedback. I think talk to each other. Share those personal stories. Connect with each other because you often get that strength while you share the same struggles and you come together very forcefully. There are so many things that I can share and tell you more about, but oftentimes I really believe that the global network is what keeps me going. I mean, I definitely have gained strength from women elsewhere in the world. I had an opportunity to meet a girl from Argentina who was my designated driver when I was in a conference in Colorado 5 years ago. She's 3 years younger than me, was just graduating international relations from the University of Colorado in Boulder. And we just clicked and we became friends. And the power that she gives me as opposed to the other way around is enormous. And I just spent 10 days with her in the Philippines going on a fishing boat with some locals. And it was part of a philanthropy project which provides for the local community in the Philippines, students, mothers, ladies who do massage and coconut oil and whatnot. And she just kept me going during that journey. We got hit by a typhoon and, you know, we almost got lost in the sea, but that girl just kept me going. I mean, she's a surfer, so definitely I will hang on to her if, you know, get in trouble. So anyway, the point being, those connections that you build across nations are powerful.
Well, we want to give those of you here an opportunity to ask questions. We have microphones in the back there. So while you're thinking about that, I wanted to have you tell the story about being in the elevator. I'm not sure how long ago this was. I heard this story. I think it's a great story. It's kind of a terrible story, too. But the question I was thinking about is, how are men reacting to the fact that women in Saudi society now are practicing law and asserting themselves? And it seemed like the elevator story was a good way to...
Okay. Well, so for those who don't know the story, it was, you know, just a normal day going to work and, you know, you call the elevator and the elevator opens and, you know, as we are walking through. And kid you not, sometimes in our conservative, environment, if you do walk into an elevator, a man would probably either step out or not join you in the elevator. So that happens. But anyway, the elevator opens up, it was full of men, and I still made my way through and went in. As soon as it closed, one young man talked to the other saying, oh, these girls and women, not only did they take jobs away from us, they're also making us suffocate in elevators. And I'm like, seriously? And obviously he just wanted me to hear it out. If I had a gun on me, it probably would end up, you know, differently. But thank God I just left to work. But again, it unfortunately demonstrates that there are issues that we face in the workforce. I think it comes from insecure men. I definitely was also encouraged by a lot of men. The way I learned and got trained and was mentored by was all by men because there were no other women in that field. So I do owe it to a man, although I would like to say I'm a self-made person, which in a sense I am, but I do owe it to a man who either helped me build thick skin by treating me so badly, or help me, you know, get about and do the right things that we all ought to do. So it goes both ways, really.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're airing a conversation recorded this past week between Shehana Al-Azaz, who was one of the first women lawyers working in Saudi Arabia, and Doug Fabrizio, the host of Radio West on KUER. Shehana Al-Azaz is an advocate for women's welfare and success in the field of law and other professions, and her story is remarkable because of the many legal and social restrictions that Saudi women endure, including being forbidden to drive or forbidden to work or travel without permission from a man. Towards the end of the conversation, they took questions from the audience.
My name is Daniel Patterson. I'm in the political science department here at the U. And first of all, thank you so much for being here and sharing your story with us. I was particularly struck by your advice of making your work visible and making what you do visible. And kind of building on that, I wonder if you could talk about the role or the importance now as some of these changes for women are happening, the role of having role models, women role models out there, and how that can help facilitate and make that, you know, move those changes forward. Are those changes happening with role models, women role models, and how do you see that playing
sure.
in now?
Sure. I think let me take you back again to my country. I think there are plenty of role models, and whether they are, you know, CEOs or top-notch businesswomen that make it into, you know, top 100 women of this world or Forbes list or whatnot, they're there. But there are also hidden heroes. Those are, you know, the mothers that are in remote areas. Those are the grandmothers that are, you know, praying so hard. There are those heroes that have untold stories. I think what definitely gets in the way in our very conservative and traditional way of living is, unfortunately, they shy away from coming to the spot and coming and sharing their stories, whether it's because of fear of being attacked or discounted, or, you know, that definitely, you know, the media would portray it in a different way. I got faced with that, and frankly speaking, I sometimes choose not to and shy away because I'm not sure how the audience will perceive it. One of the most fascinating things that happened to me during this experience while I was in Salt Lake City is a young Saudi boy came up to me last night who comes from a very different background. He was an imam at a mosque in their neighborhood south of Riyadh. And he came to me saying, well, I probably disagree with the way you dress up and how you look and how you conduct yourself. I cannot help but salute you for what you've done. To me, that was a real accomplishment. And I did want him to promise me that if we do go back home to Saudi Arabia, that we start that dialogue between his community and my community and make sure that despite the differences in views and appearances and how we might think about, you know, certain things, that those success stories, whether his or otherwise or mine, are shared with the larger community. Because I do feel like we do lack role models, and unfortunately those that shine are obviously celebrities that just become famous for being famous.
My name is Noman, and I'm a Master's of International Affairs student here at the University of Utah. I just wanted to, like, shed some light on how religion plays a big part in the Saudi politics and government, because I was actually in Saudi Arabia this summer, for 10 days, and I absolutely loved it. And I came back and told all my Western friends, I'm like, it's not like what you see in Fox News, you know? Like, people are not beheaded in the middle of the street and stuff like that. But, I mean, they have, I saw malls that were, like, better than, in Jeddah, I saw malls that were better than the ones we have in here in Ogden or Leyden or whatever, you know? But anyway, so, and I have these conversations with people where they say that Islam plays a big part, you know, in oppressing women and all that, you know? Whereas there's a whole chapter in the Quran which says, what are women's rights and this and that, how you treat them fairly and all that. Just want you to, like, shed some light on that.
Sure. It's a great question, and I struggle with it every single day. I think I could say a few things. One is, religion generally has been always hijacked by certain, you know, groups or folks or politicians to often serve their own interests and needs. I truly believe in that. And to me, religion is more of a private relationship between oneself and, you know, an almighty, whether it's Allah or something else. And I truly believe in that. Now, coming from a country that is very religious and conservative, we are reminded of religion 5 times a day. You know, calls for prayers go out loud from mosques 5 times a day. We shut down our businesses 5 times a day. So religion is something that we breathe every single day. And sometimes that causes people to turn away. Funny enough, I was the most religious in my lifetime when I went abroad to study. And that's when I really connected with my spiritual sort of mind. And once I come back and I'm kind of struggling with the fact that it's being shoved down my, you know, throat, I'm like, please, give me a breathing space. So, you know, I think there ought to be some space for people to practice their own faith and religion and beliefs rather than a matter of force. I truly believe in that. And I think that is truly the essence of Islam. There is a verse in the Islam that says, let it be your way and let my way be my way. And that is truly the essence of Islam. You know, live and let live. And I truly believe in that. But I'm also happy that you got a chance to visit and see it for your own self. I also had a similar comment from a guest last night who had spent some time in Saudi. And I kid you not, it's and I'm biased, but it's one of the most kind and generous places on earth. People will greet you with arms wide open and open their doors. And, you know, even if, and there is a story in our history where, you know, guests were coming over to a poet at that time who didn't have anything to serve other than his beloved horse. And so he sacrificed his horse to feed the guests. And it does sort of set an example for how much we're willing to give to make others feel at home and be welcomed. And I truly, truly believe in that.
Let's see if that mic works.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not used to talking in a mic.
No problem.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to the class divide. I don't know if you have any experience with this, but how class divide influences particularly women pursuing an education. I know I come from Italy, and in my country, it's very difficult for a woman to pursue an education while working, for example, because it is very different for an independent woman to find work and to pay for her studies or pay for her own lifestyle. And I know that I've experienced some of that in this country as well. Just wondering if you could speak to that in your country.
Sure. I'm glad you asked that question because I think there is a preconceived notion about all of us being wealthy and having, you know, an oil well in our backyard and driving Lamborghinis, which is not the case, right? Well, I certainly don't drive, but even if it was the case, so there is definitely poverty in the country, and unfortunately, it is in the remote villages, but it's also surrounding the cities, the major cities. It comes from a combination of immigrants, people who come for Hajj or pilgrimage and never leave. It comes from, you know, Bedouins and Saudis who have not really integrated into the civil society or the new modern way of living. And we are, at the end of the day, a capitalist economy, and that divide exists. How does it impact women? Well, I can tell you two things. While education is free for all, both girls and boys, school and universities, and actually universities even pay you an allowance to cover other expenses, so you actually get a monthly salary while you are a student. So it's a very generous arrangement by the government. The fact of the matter is it's still a difficulty to get from home to school or from home to universities or the workplace. So that transportation struggle is there. Also, the notion of being protective of women and not wanting your girl to go away and pursue a degree somewhere else is a problem. So we oftentimes find girls opting out of universities or schools because their father or husband or whatever male relative would not allow them to leave the house or do certain things. But the programs that are put there by the government, whether it's the educational programs or the transportation allowances, are there to help and make sure that is not an obstacle in their way. A change came about, and that's not really education related, but a change came about during King Abdullah's time to also create a platform for women to join the workforce. And I talked about this a bit yesterday and the day before. For the longest time, retail, shopping malls, restaurants, you name it, were served by men only. And so you would walk into a shop to buy makeup or lingerie or whatever, and it would be a man serving you. And it was so ironic and, you know, difficult to understand. Seriously? I mean, and I probably would be, I mean, not, I never cover my face, but there are ladies who do. So how are you supposed to try the makeup on or, you know, figure out what you want for yourself? And a change came about where they actually, the Ministry of Labor, forced all these businesses to feminize their stores. And so only females were allowed to operate in these stores. And it was a drastic change because overnight, all the men were out and all the females were in. It was definitely difficult to understand. And even for me, who would be used to walking into a department store and, you know, talking to, I was like, really? Is she gonna all of a sudden help me figure out what to pick? It was definitely different, but it was a good change that came about and definitely helped a lot of the females come into the task force.
I saw this statistic, tell me if this is right, more than 60% of college graduates, there are women graduate college, but only 15% of them actually enter the workforce?
Yeah, it's as low. I can't verify the exact number, but it is low, and we talked about it earlier this morning. And I see several reasons for that. One probably main reason, which is unfortunate because it's something that we take pride in, but it's the way the society is set up. The way the society is set up is this strong family bond. It's that social safety net. No matter how bad you do at school or whether you are employed or not, someone will catch you. Someone will provide for you. You'll always be protected and that you'll always have shelter. And that sometimes create a demotivation for people to not become bums, really. And so while you expect her to get a degree, you don't necessarily expect her to go and provide for herself and pursue a job. And that created, you know, part of the natural reaction of saying, you know what, great, but I can sit at home and not do nothing. Which is unfortunate because, you know, that sense of purpose and that honor in being able to work and provide for yourself is fulfilling, and nothing else can replace that. And a life without that is just, to me, unbearable. I mean, I can't even imagine how it would be. But the other issue is what we've just talked about, which is that oftentimes they're not allowed to, unfortunately. You know, there are sectors that are either restricted for men. So we talked about law historically being one. Engineering is a whole another field where it's not so clear whether we're allowed or not. And if it's seen as hazardous, you probably would not be allowed. So you can't work on an oil rig, for example. And so some of these restrictions continue to be there. There's also this idea of you can't work in a mixed environment. So naturally, you'd go into education, and you know all you serve or meet or talk to would be other women and girls. You wouldn't necessarily work in whatever mixed field there would be. But that feminization of retail and services sector changed that a little bit, and now we are there to coexist in a normal environment than what we've been used to in the past. So I hope that will help fix those numbers a bit, but we'll take time for sure.
Yeah.
So my name is Todd Derek Thomas. I'm an economics major here, but I was a sociology major before this. Total history nerd. I'm also a little bit of a religious scholar. And so I'm kind of aware that like the predominant ideology among the Saudi ruling class is like Wahhabism or Salafi, right? Am I correct in this? So what's the cultural context of this progressive movement? What's spawning it? What's starting it? What's motivating it? I mean, it's a good thing. I'm just saying, like, within a Wahhabi or a Salafi Islam context, who are the inspirations?
I think we get it. Is it different in Saudi Arabia? The thing that prompts people to.
I don't think
assert
so.
Their
I think
rights?
People, yeah.
Yeah,
I think people are prompted by the same desires that appeal to any human mankind. But two things I can say. When we refer to this terminology of Wahhabism, it always is sort of seen as a radical, fundamentalist way of viewing Islam, which, you know, to many is true. I think generally there has been a tremendous effort to shut down any radical thoughts in the country. So whether it's through what is called the National Dialogue, sponsored by the government, and so there is the King Abdulaziz Center for National Dialogue that is aimed to bring about, you know, different sects of Islam and different schools of thought and get them to start a debate and talk about things. That's one way of addressing that. The scholarship program that I talked about is another way of tackling that. And it's been a generous scholarship program where students from Saudi Arabia are sent abroad to pursue degrees in a variety of fields, fashion design, law, engineering, architecture, medicine, education, you name it. And no strings attached whatsoever. It's an absolute free ride to education. So imagine graduating without a student loan and debt. It's an amazing feeling to have. So there have been a lot of initiatives to push through the government, by the government, to push society to be a bit more open and engage in dialogue. And I'm not necessarily saying that it falls on society, because obviously we are also the product of a certain regime or a certain sort of political structure in place. I will say one thing, that my mother and grandparents remind me that it was pretty different when they grew up, and it probably was much more open when they grew up. So it seems to me that we went through this period of time where a clash of civilizations was happening, and you know, you just think you're holding on to your roots by being a bit more conservative or radical. And I don't think it's any different from what's happening in the United States at the moment, frankly. And, you know, what we are seeing in the U.S. at the moment is, I think, a result of people's fears and people's desires to protect their own dreams and hopes. And that I don't think that is right. That's not necessarily how we should engage among each other. So let's not feed into those fears and create those radical thoughts, and just come together and aspire to be a bit more fruitful in a loving way. On your question of women in particular and how the change came about, again,
historical context, I guess.
Right. So I do think it's a combination of both society wanting change and government reform. And I think it's different from how it happens elsewhere. As I said, it's not like, you know, we went down the street and started marching. It's a very different, elegant, gentle way of doing it. I'm not saying that is the best way to do it. It probably, if change doesn't come about fast enough, it'll probably become a more sort of violent and angry way of bringing about change. But so far, it's been very gentle.
we're running out of time. We've got time. Let's try to squeeze in a couple of more. There's one right here. And do we have someone with a mic over here? Yes. Go for it. And then you.
I was wondering.
Yes.
Okay, about maternity in the workforce in Saudi Arabia. So women are beginning to work in Saudi Arabia, but what about mothers? Are mothers allowed to work? And then if they are, once you become a mother, how are they viewed in the workforce? I know even in the U.S., it's still viewed with mixed emotions. Once you have a child, you know what the expectations are. And then also if you could speak to, are there ever any times where the woman is the one supporting the family versus the man?
Sure. So the simple answer is yes, mothers are allowed to work, and my mother was certainly one who pulled, you know, double shifts to be able to provide for the family, whether it's education or our household and whatnot. I certainly was the breadwinner in the family. When my father passed away at the age of 16, I became the father, and I had to provide for the younger ones and my mother, who was widowed at that time. So there are mothers, and oftentimes, frankly, I've seen mothers work much harder than the fathers and provide for the family in a much more generous way. The support system helps. The fact, going back to the point that I've just explained, we do live in a multi-generational society where the grandparents, the parents, and the kids, and the grandchildren may all be living under one roof and providing for that support. So while the mother is away bringing, you know, bread to the table, the grandparents are there to take care of the kids. I think what we lack is probably a good educational system where you can actually enroll your kids in nurseries and schools and preschools early on. That's still in the making, and it's super expensive to be able to afford that. So I think that is a weakness that we need to work on for sure. But I do feel like in this day and age with technology, we can overcome a lot of that. I'll share with you a story that happened to me a few years back. I was at a university in Jeddah on the west coast of Saudi Arabia, and I was talking to a crowd of students and just giving them, you know, my story on sort of how to maneuver. One of the students picked up my business card, and off she went. And 5 years later, she got in touch with me saying, I've now received my degree, I've become a lawyer, started practicing, I got married, I have a child, but I'm out. I'm done. I can't do those 2,000 hours a year. I can't pull an all-nighter. I can't show my pretty face every day to work. I'm out. So what's your best advice? Should I go and be a teacher, or should I get a part-time job? And I said, why don't you come and see me the next day in the office? So she came. I hired her right away, and I said, listen, here's your laptop, and you've got a phone. If I need you, I'll get a hold of you. Otherwise, I really don't need to see you. And I truly believe in that. Now, I can't employ all law students that are out there, but I think technology has helped in so many different ways. I could tell you, my boss would say, I envy the days where it took 5 days for my client to send a fax back or a letter back, right, as opposed to an instant message or email. So But we deal with it, right? We deal with it. So I think technology should provide a way of solving issues. Going back to the women driving issue that I mentioned and not being able to get to work, that's another struggle. But ride-sharing companies have opened up in Saudi, and it's become a solution, a tremendous solution to some of the restrictions that we were facing.
All right, time for one more quick one, yes.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for speaking.
Thank you.
My name is Jamie. I'm an international studies student. My question is, I know that you have this mentorship program and empowering other girls, but I also know they must face similar frustrations to what you did. What do you tell them, or like, what advice do you give to other like young female lawyers starting out about the frustrations that you've experienced and felt?
I would say it's okay. I would say, you know, we all expect struggles in life, and none of us have figured it out yet, and that is okay. It's not like we all have the answers to everything. I would say that they ought to just build thick skin and, you know, move on. Wherever they go, whether it's in a classroom or a job or whatever it is, there will be that one annoying person that will knock them down. But the most important thing is to keep going. They'll chase you, but you'll be ahead and they'll be behind. So that is the most important thing. And just keep at it. Just keep at it, for sure.
Shihan Al-Azaz, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you again for being here.
And that's Shihana Al-Azaz. She is one of Saudi Arabia's first women lawyers and an advocate for women's welfare and success in their chosen professions across the world. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. This talk was also co-sponsored by the Tanner Center for Human Rights. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.